This is the House Judiciary Committee, June 13th, 1985, Subcommittee 2.
Subcommittee will come to order. I'd like to proceed in this fashion. We have caucus at 3:30. It's a mandatory caucus. This is the order we'll take things. Senate bills 595, 236, 634, 596, 564, House Bill 254. And I think that's all we could have done before 3:30. Let me ask this. Mr. Gary here. Is he outside? Is he outside? Because if he's here, we could take his testimony at 9:03. Is he here?
He was.
Well, why don't we proceed on work session on 595? I don't think there was any amendments.
No, Mr. Chair, if you recall, there were conflicts amendments that cleared this bill up with 2164. I've got a hand and gross bill in front of you, I believe, that's marked 613. And all it does is it's a hand and gross bill that includes the conflict amendments so that 2164 doesn't conflict with this. Other than that, we heard testimony from Kathy Travis, who is representing the debtor creditor section of the bar, this bill has been supported by the bar, and there weren't amendments to that.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't think I have the conference committee amendments, or the conflict amendments.
What do we need to do?
Looks like it.
Okay.
We don't have an extra conflict.
Okay. We'll take a motion on the conflict amendments.
Chair, I'd move the conflict amendments marked 613, the Hanning Gross version, be amended to Senate Bill 595.
President Burke moves the conflict amendment 613, is noted in the Hanning Gross bill, to Senate Bill 595. Are there any objections to the amendments? Not that adopted. President Burton.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 595 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Burton moves Senate Bill 595 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll, please.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Burton?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Pipette?
Aye.
Motion adopted.
Why don't we take Mr. Gary's testimony on Senate Bill 903 at this point, and then we can return to this order. These are all goes. They're all finished. Okay.
Are we going to finish 903 at the same time?
I think we're going to work on that.
Probably have to come later. Back and work it a bit in there after we take our recess for caucus and start the floor session. But to accommodate Mr. Gary's schedule, we want to hear his testimony and take any questions now.
If he doesn't mind, all right, then I do need to go away from me.
It's fine. You know what I'm going to say.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate your accommodating me in my schedule. You are probably going to be here the rest of the afternoon, whether you or I like it or not. But nevertheless, I'll save my piece on this bill. Senate Bill 903 makes several changes to ORS Chapter 180 and other provisions relating to representation and provision of legal services to the Legislative Assembly and to the judicial branch. It didn't start out that way on the Senate side. It started out as a bill that was designed to clarify the relationship between the Attorney General's office and the Legislative Assembly. Attorney General Frohnmeyer wrote to the committee and pointed out that much of what was accomplished by Senate Bill 903 originally was already accomplished by existing statute. The relationship between the Department of Justice and the Legislative Assembly is expressly unique and distinguished from the relationship that we have with other agencies of the executive branch. legislative assembly can direct the Attorney General to appear in any action where you deem it appropriate. No executive branch agency, save the governor himself, has that power. Moreover, statutes currently on the books provide that the legislative assembly can be represented by legislative council or by any member of the Oregon State Bar as is deemed appropriate. We certainly have no problem with the current arrangement. We did point out to, on the Senate side, some concerns about aspects of our relationship that required clarification, and I'll highlight those for you. None of our concerns are addressed in Senate Bill 903 as it comes to you in the A. Gross version. First of all, Attorney General Frohnmayer pointed out that there really isn't any mechanism provided in the statutes now for how the legislative assembly, as distinguished from individual legislators, can request or demand action by the Attorney General. It isn't clear in the existing statutes whether it takes a joint resolution of both houses for the legislative assembly to direct the Attorney General or the Department of Justice to appear in a case, for example. Earlier this session, both the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate wrote to Attorney General Frohnmayer urging him to appear on behalf of Oregon as amicus curiae in a case in the United States Supreme Court involving the Citizens Utility Board right to put materials in utility billing envelopes. The Attorney General decided to make that appearance, but it wasn't clear that he was directed by the Legislative Assembly to do so. And we suggested that it might be appropriate to specify how those kinds of directions are to come to us. And implicit, I think, in the Attorney General's letter was the suggestion that there ought to be a cleaner and quicker way to do it than to require a joint resolution of both houses to put us to work on a matter of concern to the Legislative Assembly. A second concern that was expressed by the Attorney General is that the bill as it was drafted would cast some doubt on the ability of the Attorney General or the duty of the Attorney General to appear and defend individual legislators who are sued in their official capacity. I think each of you received a letter from the Attorney General earlier in the session regarding subpoenas that were served by certain pro se litigants on various members of both houses to appear and testify in criminal cases, presumably because you are expert in the criminal law that was at issue in the case. We appeared on behalf of the Speaker and some others and successfully quashed those subpoenas. And we assume that there is no intent in Senate Bill 903 to eliminate our ability to appear and represent your interests, your official interests, when you become involved in litigation in your official capacity. Somewhere between the introduction of Senate Bill 903 and the engrossed version, the purpose and scope of the bill was expanded fairly dramatically. And as the letter from Chief Justice Peterson to Chairman Springer, and I believe each of you have received a copy of that, indicates one of the principal thrusts of the bill as it comes to you would be to change the relationship between the Department of Justice and the Judicial Department with respect to legal representation. Chief Justice Peterson suggests at the end of his letter that he can't see any good reason why there shouldn't be the change that he urges you to adopt that is embodied in Senate Bill 903, and so it's a little bit, with a little bit of trepidation that I come before you and try to present to you what I believe are pretty good arguments for why the status quo ought to be maintained and the changes that are encompassed in Senate Bill 903 ought to be rejected. Basically, I have three reasons for disagreeing with the Chief Justice with regard to our relationship. First of all, let me say I appreciate his statement in the letter that it has nothing to do with the quality of service, and in fact he expresses his intent to continue to use the services of the Attorney General's office regardless of what action the Legislative Assembly may take on Senate Bill 903. Nevertheless, I think that there is some substantial disagreement with regard to the theory of government that is embodied in the Chief Justice's letter and in Senate Bill 903. Basically, the Chief Justice takes the position that the judicial department ought to be free to retain attorneys of their own choice for purposes of conducting litigation and giving day-to-day legal advice, because the attorney general is in a separate co-equal branch of government. Certainly true that the attorney general is a part of the executive branch of government, but I'm not sure, in fact, I'm quite sure that it does not necessarily follow that the judicial department must be exempt from the provisions of Chapter 180. The reason that I say that is this. To the extent that the concept of separation of powers that is implicit in the Chief Justice's argument is implicated by the representation of the executive branch on behalf of the judicial department, the very concept of separation of powers itself is a limitation on our actions as their attorney. We don't represent the Chief Justice in his judicial capacity. We do not represent the Chief Justice or any judge or any court in the decision-making process that involves the core function of judging. The Supreme Court itself has on numerous occasions, most recently in Circuit Court versus Aspey, made it very clear that the Legislative Assembly can require the judicial department to obtain services or be subject to the services provided by the executive branch of government in, for example, the area of employment relations, where they're subject to the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act and the jurisdiction of the Employment Relations Board, an executive branch agency. It can do that so long as you do not in the process interfere with the core function of the judicial department of judging. Making the judicial department subject to ORS Chapter 180 does not interfere with the core function of judging, because we don't perform any services relative to that core function. What we do provide is the same kind of service that we provide to every state officer and employee who becomes involved in litigation. And we believe that when a state officer or employee is involved in litigation, either because there is a challenge to the constitutionality of a statute or because the individual was involved in an automobile accident in his official capacity, or for any other reason, it is important and in fact essential that the state speak with one voice on legal issues that may arise in the course of that litigation. Number two, implicit, if not explicit, in the Chief Justice's position with respect to Senate Bill 903 is the idea that when there is a dispute between the executive branch and the judicial branch with respect to a legal policy question, such as the example that he gives you with respect to who pays attorney fees, the place for that issue to be resolved is in the courts. It's not surprising that the Chief Justice would take the position that the court should decide all disputes between branches of government, but I submit to you that that's neither compelled by the Constitution nor is it particularly appropriate that you should have lawsuits involving state officers on each side of the council table every time there's a disagreement. The basic philosophy that I think underlies ORS Chapter 180, the Department of Justice Act, is that the state should speak with one voice. Legal policy issues should be resolved in one place. If someone disagrees with a legal policy that is decided upon for the state of Oregon by the governor or the legislative assembly or as interpreted by the attorney general, then that individual can go to court and seek review of the state's position. There are rare occasions when it is appropriate for various state officers in their official capacity to appear in court and have a matter decided by the court so that there can be finality with respect to a constitutional or legislative issue. Those occasions, I would submit, are very rare indeed. They arise only in those instances in which the only way that major issues regarding the structure and form of government can be resolved is to have the government suing itself and having the court resolve that dispute ultimately and completely. You all are probably aware of circumstances in which that has occurred. They occur very, very rarely, and I would submit that existing statutes, specifically ORS 18235, provides a perfectly adequate mechanism by which outside counsel can be authorized for branches of government or individual officers and employees when it is necessary for two or more state agencies, officers, or employees to appear in court and argue that the state's position is different than the central state legal policy identified by the Attorney General. We believe that Senate Bill 903, as it comes to you in the A. Engrossed version, is unnecessary and, in fact, is in many respects bad policy. And for for that reason, we respectfully disagree with the Chief Justice and urge your favorable consideration of the points that I made to you today, and we ask that this bill be tabled.
Okay, are there any questions for Mr. Gary? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gary, has this been a problem in other states, and if so, how has it been resolved?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, it is an issue of frequent discussion when attorneys general get together who are all concerned, of course, with the issues of state legal policy and how legal services are delivered. Various different states have dealt with the problem in a variety of different ways. I think it's fair to say that the decided trend across the country is toward the kind of consolidated legal services that have been the rule in Oregon for a good many years. In the state of Washington, consolidated legal services, including consolidated legal services to the Judicial Department, is the rule. In the state of California, it is the rule, although there is a good deal more flexibility with respect to the freedom of the Legislative Assembly to act on its own accord. And I think there are many more occasions when you have state versus state kinds of lawsuits there. The state of Idaho runs against the grain in that respect, in that there is no consolidated legal services. Every state agency is entitled to hire their own lawyer whenever they please. That goes also for the Legislative Assembly. I believe that in the past, at least in the past two legislative sessions in Idaho, bills have been passed by the Legislative Assembly creating a consolidated legal services program very much like that in Oregon. Those bills have been vetoed by the governor. And so they still have the diffused provision of legal services. If you go across the country, I think you would find a little bit of difference in the way that the various branches of government relate to each other and obtain legal services. But it is a problem across the country. There are different solutions in different states, and it is not uncommon at all for the Oregon system as it exists now to be the system that is followed.
Further questions? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Gary.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close the hearing on 903. We will return to it later in the afternoon or early evening for further hearings in the work session. Representative Kopeski has suggested that in the few minutes left to us, we hopefully could take favorable action on several of the bills that are scheduled for work session today. I believe he suggested that Senate Bill 236 might be one of those bills upon which favorable action could be taken. Council, if you could review that with us, please.
Mr. Chairperson, the only person who testified on this bill was Bill Linden of the Judicial Department. This would remove the minimum $75 mediation fee. Currently, there is no maximum fee, and the Multnomah County charge is $95. There is no opposition, no amendment.
Okay, is there further comment or question? Is there a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Burke.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 236 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
We look a lot alike.
Well, Multnomah County, I knew you'd want to help
me.
It's Multnomah County.
Representative Burton moves Senate Bill 236 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Kennedy?
Aye.
Burton?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Let's try next. We've got cemetery plots. Senate Bill 634.
We had a hearing the other day, but I don't recall that anybody appeared to testify on it. The problem is that there's a statute 97.630 which provides that if you have a cemetery plot, if you don't have directions from the deceased as to what to do with that cemetery plot, you can't dispose of it. Apparently there was a person who had two plots and was unable to sell them. Senate Bill 634, as amended, would permit the representative of the deceased owner of the plot to sell unoccupied spaces as property of the deceased estate when there are no existing or vested rights of interment or when such rights have been waived. The bill was amended by the committee, by the Senate Business, Housing, and Finance Committee, to require that a notice be sent to purchasers of spaces and family plots, providing notification of the law as amended by Senate Bill 634. Senator Monroe is available to testify in favor of this bill, but is not available right now.
Okay, well, I had a chance to confer with Senator Monroe, and I think he merely restated that his testimony would be basically that of the summary, and that it, apparently the matter came to his attention following a request or inquiry by his constituent. Are there any questions? Counsel, can you advise how this would affect or would relate to the rule against perpetuities?
No, Mr. Chair, I cannot give you that kind of information right now. Give me 15 minutes, perhaps. Town Council says he doesn't think it applies.
Okay. Maybe Ms. Robinson can help us out.
Sure, whatever you want.
Are there any further questions? Motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
634 to full committee. Do pass.
Representative Bellamy moves Senate Bill 634 to the full committee for the do pass recommendation. Is there further discussion?
As long as it doesn't apply to perpetuities, right?
As long as you don't have to carry it, right? Further discussion?
Article.
If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Burton?
Oh, yes.
Peterson?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Okay, 596.
Mr. Chairperson, this bill relates to the Uniform Gifts to Minors Act. There was a memo testimony to Bill Sarah Baker, an attorney, testified in favor of the bill. Mr. Stan Lee is presently sent a letter of support. There is no opposition, no amendments. If there are any questions, Mr. Lee is here to, Mr. Lowe, excuse me, is here to answer questions.
Thanks, Mr. Barilla. Are there any questions?
I don't have a copy of the game.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
I move Senate Bill 596 to the floor and do pass.
Representative Bellamy moves Senate Bill 596 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there further discussion or questions? Good bill, Representative. If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Burton?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Representative Burton, if you have any questions,
I'm glad to take those in full committee.
Good.
Okay, 564.
Mr. Chairperson, this bill was brought forth from Frank Browner, President of OBA. The purpose of the bill is to restore the law as it was pre-1981, which means that personal property tax priorities take subject to. There's no amendments, no opposition to the bill.
Members, excuse me, go ahead.
We also have a letter in our file that's received from a David R. Reese, R-I-S, a Rice, in Coos County, the legal counsel.
Okay. I want to let members take a moment to review that letter. I think it just came into us. Apparently, he takes a position contrary to that of the sponsors and suggests that counties or tax collection jurisdictions, particularly counties, ought to retain a priority for personal property tax liens that are levied against or recorded against real property, notwithstanding the normal priority that would be given to liens that have been recorded earlier. While members are looking at that letter, Mr. Bronner, would you like to respond or offer any additional comments? Or
Chairperson, I was named Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. I have runners I'm looking for. Now, with regard to the letter that gave me a few moments ago. The counties on the Senate side did not oppose. I do have, however, in file an August 7, 1984 letter signed by the same assistant county counsel from Coos County. I read just a part, and I have one copy. In reviewing the letter that the committee has received, it would imply that prior to 1981, these liens, personal property tax liens, did have some priority. I quote from the assistant counsel's own letter. Prior to 1981, these tax liens were subject to the usual priority rule. That is, first in time, first in right. This letter reviews Judge Barron's decision. And under this decision, he is writing to Tycor Title, now only the tax lien created by charging is subject to the usual priority rules. Now, we were a part of 1981 legislation, and we thought it made certain that personal property tax liens would stand in their own right and in their own priority. Senate Bill 564 before you clarifies what we thought the law was prior to 1981 and after 1981. And I have just one copy, Mr. Chairman, so if I can give that to you.
Sure. Why don't, I know, Representative Kapinski, I think we best take a recess at this point. So that allows a little time to look further at the materials that Mr. Rice supplied to us here right at the last moment, and perhaps allow Mr. Kamel to speak more authoritatively on the position of the counties, reaffirm their non-opposition, make copies of that earlier correspondence to which Mr. Braun has referred. So I would recommend Chair Kapinski that we go ahead and take a recess motion.
Yes.
The only thing that I would also suggest to the members is that we're talking about personal property taxes and not real property taxes. And I guess I have a problem that there's a lot of people that have a lien. When you go out, we're talking about a piece of equipment. When you go out and buy a piece of equipment, I'm not so sure that at that stage in the game that personal property taxes ought to have priority as far as the lien basis. So, as I reread the letter from the individual, it becomes more clear to me that you need to understand the difference between personal and real property taxes, and that makes a difference in the bill.
Understand that you need to go. They never have had priority, and until this recent decision, there was never any question. Yeah, that's
okay. We're going to have to recess for purposes of a caucus. So we have 564, 254, 90. Come to order. I don't know if I have a.
We're
in the middle of 564. Thank you, Representative.
Yeah, you're right.
And in a now
564.
For the record, I had a conversation with the representative from the counties, who has to be in a different hearing. And the counties are still, even after the concern by Coos County individual, which I was not here for that discussion, but counties remain neutral on the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bell.
I send Senate Bill 564 to the full committee.
Representative Bell may send Senate Bill 564 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Peterson.
Okay, I heard what you were saying about the counties, but I'm having difficulty understanding how there could not be some financial impact on the counties. I mean, can you explain that? It seems to me if the order of the lien is different and the counties are no longer early on, maybe Mr. Bronner can speak to it.
Nancy, I can comment on that. You got to understand that there will not necessarily be a financial impact. All this allows is it allows an easier way for the counties to collect their debt. By attaching a lien, and the priority of the lien does not mean you collect the money. All it does is make it easy, and the lien becomes a mechanism. In reality, there would be minimal impact to a county simply because you'd have to find the people who are not going to pay their personal property taxes to even find your poor people.
Mr. Chair,
Chair.
President Burton.
I also, Nancy, in the conversation, Mr. Brunner may want to come up and verify this if he would, but I was there at the time that Jefferson Kopetsky and Mr. Gunnell and Mr. Brunner were discussing this, and apparently they have not ever, in everybody's experience, no one ever really ever prioritized these in the sense of this in the past. Is that correct? So that really, even though this speaks to the prioritization question, nobody really does that in practice.
That is, Frank Brunner with the Oregon Banking Association, that is correct. As a matter of fact, most counties were surprised with this decision, as we were. And today, I think the only county that considers that they are a priority is the county of Coos.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Clerk, call the roll, please.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bunn?
Pass and come back to me.
Burton?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Kopetsky?
Bunn votes aye.
Kopetsky votes aye.
Mr. Chair,
motion to the... Oh, did you want to change?
No, that? No, that's fine.
A particular national origin, such as French, and not be an alien if they were born in this country. Someone who is of French origin and is an alien, i.e. not a citizen of this country.
Attitude toward the original language and the amendments that replaced the original.
I'm sorry, Representative Bunn.
Well,
yes, I have a little clawing going on over there.
On page 1, line 14 through 16, it has the current language. Nothing in this subsection precludes the court from making an award under this section against parties who were acting pursuant to a statute that is held by the court to be unconstitutional. It bothers me a little bit that a citizen could be following the statute, be mandated by the statute to follow it, be in good faith, and then court strike that statute down, the person who followed it get nailed for attorney's fees. And I guess I'm favorable to the amendments and interested in your reaction to them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, that language, as you point out, was added in the A. Gross version. It was not part of the bill as it was drafted by the Attorney General's office. On the Senate side in the Judiciary Committee, the issue of whether reliance upon a statute ought to be a defense was discussed. And frankly, the Attorney General's response was, it is a policy question for you all to decide how broadly you want to make this. There's certainly nothing wrong from a legal standpoint in saying that if you rely upon an unconstitutional statute and you follow it, you do so at your own risk. I'd like to identify what I consider to be three different levels of a policy for you to consider with respect to that. At the first level is a state agency which follows a statute that is held to be unconstitutional subsequently and is then assessed attorney fees for doing what the board of directors of the state tells it to do. There's, I think, a pretty good justification for saying, well, that the agency is just out of luck then, because what you're really talking about is state dollars. And if the legislative assembly wants to require the state agency to pay attorney fees when it follows the legislature and the legislature has itself made a mistake, that's perfectly justifiable. It's also perfectly justifiable to reach the contrary conclusion and say only the legislative assembly should take responsibility for its errors, and we expect our state agencies to follow the laws which we enact. And I would point out there's a middle ground, which is there are occasions, few occasions, when the Attorney General opines that statutes passed by the legislature are unconstitutional. And it may well be that we will make a mistake and opine that a legislative enactment by the Legislative Assembly is constitutional. And an agency may rely not only upon the act, but upon the advice of their attorney in following a statute that is subsequently declared to be unconstitutional. And I can see a perfectly good justification for saying if you're following your attorney's advice and you follow a constitutional statute, you ought not to deduct for attorney fees. The second level of policy issue for you to consider is local governments, counties and cities, which follow the acts of the Legislative Assembly. They don't have access to the Attorney General to ask for our opinion except by prevailing upon a state officer or employee to ask for the opinion. Moreover, they're creatures of the legislature, and there is, I think, a little bit better argument that you ought not to stick them if they're following the dictates of the legislature. Finally, and I think the lowest level of policy justification for the provision that you refer to is where you're dealing with private individuals. An employer, for example, who's following a statute that says you must do X, does X, and then finds out that the statute that commanded him to do that is unconstitutional and he's liable for attorney fees. The justification for that result, I think, is a little bit harder to make the case for than if you're talking about a state agency. So I see a sliding scale on that issue.
On the private party issue, you know, I've been in court for years and the judge says you're presumed to know the law, you're required to follow the law, and it's, in fact, you're presumed to know the statute, you're required to follow the statute. It's incredible to me we would say that in court and then say, but you maybe shouldn't follow it, and you decide, and the user beware. You know, talk about consumer protection. We're putting out laws from the legislature and then saying you, the consumer, have to beware. You said there's maybe a little less policy reason for doing that to the private party. Is there any policy justification for saying we as a legislature make laws and mandate you follow them, but not really, or at your own risk?
Well, I think the policy justification would be that individuals have an independent responsibility to make constitutional judgments. And the best example is if the legislature were to do something completely absurd, like pass a law that said that private employers cannot employ more than 20% women on their management staff. That's a clearly unconstitutional statute. I don't know that there ought to be any kind of immunity because somebody says, look, I'm just doing what my legislature told me to do under those circumstances.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. Our acts, as we pass them, are presumed to be constitutional. And supposedly, we act in a reasonable fashion. I have no problem with saying that a state agency is liable if they follow statute and it's unconstitutional, but I have a significant problem with saying a private party that follows what we mandate they follow has to do so at their own risk. We're not asking the public to put very much credence in our actions if we do that. So I guess, I favor the concept of the bill. I favor the bill, but I think that except for state agencies, we should exempt those who follow statutes in good faith from liability.
Finally, hear from Senator Hendrickson.
Thank you again for the record, Margie Hendrickson. I'd like to give you the reason why this was put in, and also, I think, an example of where you have a blatant sexually discriminatory statute that was not carried out by a state agency. It was carried out by Safe Corporation, and that was the Hewitt versus Safe case, which I referred to earlier, which actually created the state equal rights amendment. The legislature had passed, and it wasn't an old statute, I think it was 77, with respect to death benefits under worker compensation in the instance where couples were cohabitating and not married. If the industrial worker who got killed, and there was a child, if the industrial, I'm recalling this from memory, but I think these are the facts of the case, if the industrial worker that got killed was a male, then the mother of the child could collect benefits. If the industrial worker that got killed was female, then the father could not collect benefits, and that was Hewitt versus Safe. Safe asserted the defense that they were simply carrying out a statute which was blatantly discriminatory on the basis of gender on its face. The ACLU had requested, and that's why the Senate committee put in this particular version, and I'll just read you, if you'd permit me, this is very short, from the ACLU. It says it's possible, and they were referring to the bill as originally drafted,
It is possible that subsection 3 could be read to allow an award of fees only against a defending party who is, quote, responsible for discrimination. I'm not sure what the term responsible is intended to mean in that context, but I'm concerned that a defending party might argue that it was not responsible for a particular act of discrimination because it was simply carrying out a statutory directive. And then it cites Hewitt versus Sate, which, if you want the citation, is 294 Oregon 33, 1982, where a certain statute was held to constitute unlawful gender discrimination. If 494, without the amendment, had been in effect, the claimant would presumably have sought an award of attorney's fees, but SAFE could have contested the award on the ground that it was not responsible for the discrimination since it was bound to follow the statute until a court ruled otherwise. So that was the rationale and the policy reason. I appreciate what Representative Bunn has said in terms of a problem, but I think you might want to consider the context of where. Now, this is I don't believe SAFE is considered a state agency. I believe it is considered a quasi-public corporation. And I'm sure the Attorney General will comment on that.
Emphasis on the quasi.
Representative Bunn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, SAFE has legal counsel from the Attorney General's office. And the policy issue that says you have advice from the AG would be true for SAFE. Marty, my question would be, if you have a law that's been in effect for 4 years, everyone has been following it as if it were accurate. It's a good faith operation. A private party comes into court and that law is declared unconstitutional. They had no legitimate way of knowing it was going to be. Do you think they should be nailed for attorney's fees?
Are you talking about the private party or state agency?
Private party.
Well, first of all, how would a private party come within the ambit of
the city county? See, private
parties. Well, they'd have to have the color state law. I mean, they would have to be acting under some official.
No. This includes private action, private parties, cities, counties, and the state. See, I don't mind if we.
All right, but in order, Representative, but I'm sure as you know, in order for someone to prevail on a constitutional basis, you have to have some form of state action involved with that private party's behavior. In order to even be able to file that kind of a claim.
As my understanding, and perhaps the Attorney General's representative, Mr. Chairman, if you discriminate as a private party, the action can be brought against you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, Senator Hendrickson is correct that if there's going to be a claim under Article 1, Section 20, or some similar provision of the Oregon Constitution, you're going to have to show that there is state action. Representative Bunn is correct that this bill is broader than simply a prohibition on state action, in that if there is a state statute that makes it unlawful to discriminate in affairs between private parties, such as discrimination in housing, someone brings a claim against a private party under that statute, this bill would provide for an award of attorney fees in that instance.
But how, if I might add, that in that instance, how could the person, they wouldn't be claiming that they were discriminated because the statute was unconstitutional. They'll be bringing the action under a civil rights statute. So I don't see the problem.
I think the example that was given in Hewitt versus SAFE is a good one, except for some disagreement about the status of SAFE. But it could have been, the same case could have arisen with Liberty Mutual Northwest, right, as the insurer. And in that case, Liberty Northwest would have come in and defended against the claim, saying the statute passed by the legislature says we don't pay benefits under these circumstances.
But, Mr. Chairman, the only point I'm making is, while that may be considered an absurd statute, there may be statutes that are much closer calls, and people are operating in good faith under those statutes in a process of court action. That statute is declared unconstitutional, and that party who was acting in good faith now, private party, is held liable. And what I'm suggesting is we could very simply amend the bill to provide that state agencies that rely on statutes pay the attorney's fees and other parties do not, and that would take care of that good faith issue.
Well, if I could respond to that, certainly is a policy choice. I, again, though, say if you have, for example of the insurance company that is dispensing worker compensation benefits, do you really want to remove them from this? I mean, what makes them different from, say, if it had been a private insurance company that had denied death benefits to the child of a female industrial worker that was killed, what would be the policy reason to want to provide that kind of protection?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bond.
Policy reason is if you use a statute that is not so absurd, and you have a private party that is coming under that statute, and they go into court and they say, I relied on this statute, and it in fact was a statute that was more reasonable, the question I'm asking is, should they be required to pay attorney's fees in that case? And my answer is no, I don't think they should.
I guess the state action question is the amount of government involvement. Insurance companies that enter into the market to do worker compensation are entering into a heavily state regulated system. They're heavily involved in state activity. I can understand the situation where you don't want some innocent citizen walking down the street really is not connected with the state in any way to have that. I don't think we're talking about those kind of occasions. The only way anyone in the private sector would even be subject to these kind of lawsuits is if they're heavily interconnected with state in some sort of activity. But I just, you know, that this is a policy matter for you to decide. The Senate decided it in favor of putting this provision in, and it certainly is a policy judgment that could go either way.
Representative Burton?
So, make sure I understand, they're trying to get this a little clearer in my mind as far as sequencing of events goes. A person who would bring a matter to court based on the definition here of an illegal discriminatory act, and the defense of that may be that this was, that there was simply a statutorily followed procedure in the award, and that's found to be that discrimination occurred. The plaintiff then would receive the award of the court of the attorney fees, but in what place do we find the? And I'm trying to follow up or make it a little more clear in my mind exactly what is it Representative Bond is getting at. I guess I don't share with you that if we have enacted statutes that are basically unconstitutional in the sense that they create a discriminatory situation, that the state ought not to be held liable for that.
Well, I agree with you there. I think the state.
Okay, then I missed your argument. Yes, because if that's the case, then why are we disagreeing?
Well, there are three groups of parties that can be held liable. The state, if the action is brought against the state. Cities and counties, if the action is brought against the city or county. Or a private party, if an action is brought against
the
private party.
You're talking about the other two.
I think the state should be held liable if it's based on a statute, because we made it and we should live with it. I don't think the cities and counties and private parties should be held liable for what we did when we mandate that they follow what we do.
Representative, if I can respond, I'd like to back up for a minute and clarify a couple of things in the process. And take a situation involving an individual who is seeking to find a place to live and goes to a private landlord and says, I'd like to rent your home, and the private landlord says, I'm sorry, but the statutes say that I can't rent to black people. And I know that's an absurd example, but assume for the moment that that statute exists. And the there is another statute that says it will be unlawful to discriminate in housing on the basis of personal characteristics. The person seeking housing files a lawsuit against the private landlord and says, you discriminated against me in housing, and furthermore, the statute that you're relying upon as the basis for doing that is unconstitutional. If the court agrees that the statute is unconstitutional and makes a judgment in favor of the plaintiff for unlawful discrimination, under this bill, as it's written now, the landlord will be liable to pay attorney fees in addition to whatever damages are assessed.
Is there any remedy for that individual then to... against the state because it was following, is there any remedy that the individual has then, and going back and saying, all right, fine, I can reassess those fees, but I was following statutes. What's the remedy for that individual?
There would be none.
If I could also...
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. There's no way, even if it was unclear and unconstitutional.
I want to also stress here, we're talking about a very narrow area, and that is only discrimination of a personal type, whether it's based on racial discrimination, gender-based discrimination. And so I think it's the person who's carrying out this statute, which is basically the statute is ordering them to discriminate against an Oregon citizen on some basis such as race, gender. It's hard to imagine that they're not on some sort of notice that they are probably violating that person's rights. And I think in that instance, if they are a state agency or now SAFE, which relies on the Attorney General, they should seek an Attorney General's opinion as to whether to carry that out. If they are a local government, they also have the advice of counsel. If they're involved in getting state money, they may have some contractual agreement where they may have some rights to indemnification. I think there are ways, but the thing I want to impress, I guess, on you is the fact that we're talking about a very narrow range, and that is statutes or rules with respect to this type of discrimination. It's not going to be some gray area, I don't think, where the person wouldn't suspect that the statute might not be discriminatory.
Could I just ask, Senator, in line 15, near the end there, where it says, uses the term statute, does that include ordinances as well?
Where is that?
Line 15.
I think it's, actually we didn't have a discussion of that. I'll defer to Bill Gary. I think it was considered to be a state statute.
Yeah, the reference, I think, is to state statutes and not to local ordinances. I wasn't a party to the discussions when this was added as an amendment.
Yeah.
But I would, if you intended to encompass ordinances, you probably ought to say so. If I might make a suggestion for the committee to consider in an effort to bring the various viewpoints together. It may be that everyone can be satisfied and agree that someone who in good faith or on advice of counsel relies upon a statute ought not to be liable because the statute is declared unconstitutional. And perhaps some language that refers to the good faith of the defendant would satisfy everyone. That would take care of concerns that have been expressed about the clearly unconstitutional statute or the defendant that relies upon a statute choosing to remain blissfully ignorant about the constitutional problems that may exist with it.
If I could respond to that, I would not want just good faith reliance. I might be interested in acting upon advice of counsel, because then that would have the effect of having people seek an opinion as to whether or not a particular statute was unconstitutional. I also want to say that the document that I was reading from and the suggestion was from Charles Nichol. I just want to put that on the record.
Well, let me just comment, I guess. Part of the problem I'm having in all this is, I mean, I think we left out the governor gets to sign or allows statutes to go into law, and it's not just the legislature that makes laws. I mean, he's very much part of the process. He can say no to the things that pass both houses, as we all know. And so it seems that, you know, we represent the people, theoretically, and he's supposed to, right now it's a he. He represents people, theoretically, and I mean, I don't know if we should get locked into this thought, but it's just these collective minds that are saying something's constitutional or unconstitutional, or a theory of government is people out there making these laws. Representative Bond.
Sure. Marty, I represent a couple of small communities, and they, a lot of times, don't ask for legal advice because of the costs, but they do read the statutes, and they do read the information League of Oregon City sends out, and they do rely on those statutes. My question would be, if we said the state government is liable in all cases, we don't put a good faith test in for them, but then once we drop down from state government, say those who act in good faith or on advice of counsel, so that we aren't requiring more people to go to attorneys, but they have to make a good faith showing or go to counsel. Is that something you could accept?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure legally what good faith means in terms of what that defense would mean. Also, if you had a plaintiff that was suing a city, and the state wasn't a party to it, that would mean that that individual would not get a recovery.
Yeah, I guess I get a little bit worried that good faith, and you get to go to an attorney, and the attorney says, yeah, it's constitutional.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there is. I would think there would be a cause of action against that private attorney then, but courts are deciding all the time what's reasonable, what's good faith, what's appropriate. I mean, if we put a burden on the defendant of showing good faith, then they have some responsibility.
Yeah, I'm wondering if I can walk at this just sort of from the other direction. I guess I'm persuaded by the sense that it's hard for me to believe a situation where someone wouldn't really, even notwithstanding any statutes or ordinances there, wouldn't realize that they might be taking a discriminatory action. Also, I would assume this does not bind, or does it? The court to make an award. I would assume that if they were to say, listen, I think this person acted in good faith, that award would not be made. I would assume the court has a discretion.
Mr. Chair, yeah, this has nothing to do with the merits of the case. The person first has to prove to a court or to a jury, probably to a court, that in fact something occurred. This is only talking about how you divide the responsibility up for the payment of attorney's fees.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burton, if somebody prevails on the claim, on the substantive claim, there is no discretion under this bill for the court to deny an award of attorney fees. Once the discrimination claim is successful and the judgment is final, attorney fees follow as a matter of course. The language in section 1, line 6, I'm sorry, is shall be entitled to recover. It's mandatory.
Yeah, I want to backtrack too, because we are talking about attorney's fees. We're not talking about damage awards, because I misspoke myself. That would be decided under other principles of law. We're simply talking about attorney's fees.
Any further questions? Representative Bach.
Bill, if we wanted to change the language in line 15 from parties to cover all state entities, could we describe that as state agencies, or would it need to be something other than that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I think state agencies, officers, or employees is the normal term that's used to describe whole group of us that sometimes find ourselves in litigation.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to try to run a conceptual amendment if you would entertain a motion.
Could I ask counsel, who's familiar with the suits and discrimination area, first to comment upon good faith standards?
Mr. Chairman, I've probably brought at least 10 or 15 or 20 cases in both state and federal courts of civil rights. And the standard defense is usually good faith. I think it's a standard defense. People just say, hey, we thought it was a good idea. Not all the time do people act or make decisions based on full knowledge, and it's kind of act as they've acted in the last 50 years. Sometimes it's not real good faith. Also, as to the issue of advice of counsel, some of these schools, school boards, local agencies have had the advice of counsel, and it's been wrong. And I won't name some of the attorneys that have given bad advice, but you would be surprised that some attorneys are not well-versed in civil rights law, and they just give bad advice. And schools rely on it, and they're found wrong.
Ms. Carey.
Mr. Chair, I have no disagreement with anything that council says, but I wanted to point out that that my suggestion for your consideration was not that you create a good faith exception to the award of attorney fees, but that you create an exception for private parties and local governments where they rely on a state statute in good faith.
Because there's a whole body of case law in civil rights litigation about what is good faith, particularly with respect to instrumentalities of the state or municipal, and it's something you'd really have to delve into, and I am glad that Mr. Gary made that point. We're not talking about an exception to their liability, only a state statute.
Representative Buck.
Mr. Chairman, my conceptual amendment would be this, that state agencies, officers, or employees are subject to the language on lines 14, 15, 16, which means that they could not raise a good faith or advice of counsel defense in the case of reliance upon a state statute. And further, that local government and private parties could rely upon a good faith or advice of counsel defense only in the instance of reliance upon a state statute.
Create a new substantive right, or is it your intent not to create a new substantive right to remove defense?
It would just be allowed to raise that as a defense.
To the attorney's fees only.
Okay. That's correct.
Senator, did you want to comment?
No, I'm just holding my breath. And we certainly don't want to be dealing with the substantive underlying law here. We're just talking to that. Very narrow issue is getting attorney's fees if you prevail in one of these kind of civil rights cases. And there's a whole body of case law out there, but with defenses are available, and I'm sure Representative Bunn did not intend to get into that hole.
I did not intend to touch that at all.
Do you want to indicate any kind of support or opposition to the proposed amendment by Representative Bunn?
Well,